Welcome back, everybody. We're diving into the fall 2024 issue of Think 2020 magazine today.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, you gave me a really interesting mix of articles here to go through.
I did.
So yeah.
We're gonna have some fun.
Yeah, we've got everything from ethics in VR to the never-ending changes in Canadian tax policy. I have a feeling we might find some surprises along the way.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think what's really interesting is how all of these articles, even though they seem like different topics, they all kind of touch on this theme of dealing with uncertainty.
Okay.
You know, whether it's the metaverse and all of the uncharted territory there, or the challenges of doing audits remotely, or just trying to figure out all of the complexities of tax regulations, it seems like there's this common thread of needing to adapt to a world that's constantly changing.
Okay. I like that. I like where this is going. Let's start with that Eric Cohen article about creating ethical standards in virtual environments.
Okay.
He talks about presence in VR and how it really blurs the lines between reality and the digital world.
Right. And it brings up all of these like questions about how we make sure people act ethically when those lines get blurry. Like imagine, you know, you're in a business negotiation and it's happening in VR. How do you even prevent manipulation when the whole setting is like designed to influence your decisions?
Yeah, that is a little unsettling.
Like
how do I know if I'm saying yes to this deal because it's good or because the virtual environment is making you want to say yes?
Exactly. And it goes beyond just business too.
Yeah.
Cohen also talks about this thing called the online disinhibition effect. You know how people can be more like aggressive online?
Oh yeah.
Or just reckless because they feel anonymous. Mm-hmm. Well, imagine that, but amplified in VR, where you're like actually embodied in that world.
Right.
It could create a space where toxic behavior just runs wild.
Yeah.
Think about the potential for virtual harassment or even virtual assault.
Wow, I hadn't thought about that. It seems like we need to set up some rules for these spaces like yesterday.
Definitely. And it's not just about setting rules. It's like, how do you even enforce them? How do you identify and then penalize people who are doing bad things in the virtual world?
Right.
It's a complicated problem. And, you know, the answers are going to have a big impact on how we live and work in the metaverse.
This is really making me rethink strapping on that VR headset.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's shift to something maybe a bit more grounded.
Okay.
Let's talk about Gundy Jeffrey's article on the CPAB Audit Quality Insights Report.
Oh, good one.
Yeah, this one raises some concerns about, like, problems with how auditors are assessing risk, especially with remote auditing becoming more common.
Yeah, you're exactly right. CPAB actually found a pretty concerning number of issues in these audits, especially the ones done remotely. And this is really important for, you know, financial professionals.
Right.
Because if audits are becoming less reliable, then it makes you wonder about like how accurate financial reporting is and even the whole integrity of the market.
Yeah. Okay. I see your point. So what's causing these problems? Is it that auditors are just having trouble adapting to working remotely?
I think that's part of it. Traditionally, auditors would go to a company in person.
Right.
They'd get a feel for the company's culture, see how things work, have those face-to-face conversations. Mm-hmm. It's just much harder to be skeptical and spot problems when you're only looking at spreadsheets and doing video calls.
Yeah. It's like trying to diagnose a patient over the phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can get some information, but you miss out on those little cues and gut feelings when you're not in the same room with somebody.
Yeah. And CPAB specifically pointed out that auditors need to improve how they're assessing climate-related risks, which are becoming really important for financial reporting. But, like, how do you do that accurately when you're not even there?
Yeah.
It's a challenge, for sure, and one that auditors need to figure out if they want to stay credible.
It seems like this also ties back into that idea of handling uncertainty. It's not just about adjusting to new technology. It's like we need to rethink our whole approach to risk and due diligence in a world where remote work is becoming the norm.
Exactly. Which leads us perfectly into our next article,
which
tackles another area that's full of uncertainty, Canadian tax policy.
Oh boy, buckle up. M. Litter's article is pretty direct. He's calling out all the constant changes to the tax code and how it's basically creating a climate of anxiety and unpredictability for businesses.
He's not wrong. Canada's tax system used to be known for being stable, but now it's like a moving target.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in just the last 7 years, we've seen big changes to pretty much everything. How private corporations are taxed, trust reporting requirements, you name it. It's a lot to keep up with.
It's not even just how often things change. It's how complicated the changes are. Litter argues that a lot of these revisions have been implemented so poorly,
yeah,
and there's a lack of clarity, which just adds to the confusion.
It's like trying to build IKEA furniture with instructions that keep changing.
Right.
No wonder businesses are frustrated.
But haven't some of these changes, like the ones about how family businesses get passed down, been designed to actually help businesses?
True. The intentions might have been good, but Litter points out, you know, it's all about the details.
Yeah.
The latest revisions to those rules have actually made things more complicated.
Oh, no.
There are tighter restrictions and guidelines that are kind of vague. It's a classic case of good intentions going wrong.
So instead of making things easier for families to, like, pass on their businesses, it's just created more headaches and more uncertainty.
Exactly. And it goes beyond just being frustrating.
Right.
This uncertainty scares away investment, stops innovation, and in the end, makes Canada less competitive globally. You see this in big sectors like technology and healthcare, where companies hesitate to invest because they have no idea what the tax landscape will be like even a few years from now.
It's like that theme is popping up again. Whether it's ethics in the metaverse, the challenges of remote auditing, or the mess of tax policy, it's like we're living in a time of constant uncertainty.
You got it. It's forcing us to rethink everything, adapt our strategies, and find new ways to navigate a world that just won't sit still.
Okay, well, speaking of uncertainty, let's move on to Kim Moody's article.
Oh, yes.
He tackles a pretty controversial topic. It's about the government's decision to give subsidies to the journalism industry through those tax credits.
I read the one.
He doesn't hold back, calls the whole thing ridiculous, and says it actually weakens the independence of the press.
It raises some really interesting questions.
Yeah. So for our listeners, just to break it down, the government has these three main journalism initiatives. You've got charitable donations for nonprofits. Then there are those refundable tax credits for qualifying news organizations, and then personal tax credits for digital news subscriptions.
Right. And it's going to cost taxpayers something like $595 million over 5 years. But Moody's main concern isn't even the money, it's the potential for bias.
Yeah, he's saying that when news organizations rely on the government for funding, they might avoid reporting on things that are critical of the government.
Right, it's like, don't bite the hand that feeds you.
Exactly.
So it brings up a really fundamental question. Should the government even be involved in propping up the journalism industry? Shouldn't a truly free press be able to do well without government help?
Moody definitely thinks so. He thinks these tax credits make people think there's bias, even if there isn't any.
Yeah.
And he doesn't like the way it's decided which organizations get the credits. It all comes down to this expert panel appointed by, you guessed it, the government.
Right, which, as Moody points out, is a system that's practically begging for political influence.
Yeah, the government basically gets to pick winners and losers in the media, and that's not a good thing.
Not at all.
So we've got the ethical issues of the government being involved in the media, the financial burden on taxpayers, and the potential for bias.
It's a lot to consider.
It's complicated.
It is.
No easy answers.
No.
And it makes you think about what the role of journalism should be in a democracy.
Absolutely.
And how do we ensure we have a free and independent press without compromising their integrity?
Big questions.
This is a good transition, though, to our next article, which is about a different type of responsibility.
Okay.
Corporate social responsibility. Gerald Treitz gives this framework for companies that want to move beyond just doing the bare minimum when it comes to CSR.
Uh-huh.
And he says they should really make social and environmental considerations a central part of their business strategies.
It's about going beyond just writing a nice sustainability report and actually making CSR a core part of how the company works.
So it's not just a PR move.
Yeah.
It's like walking the walk.
Exactly.
Okay.
And Treitz has this step-by-step process.
Okay.
And he says you start by defining the company's vision for CSR, and he even suggests looking at the UN's Sustainable Development Goals for inspiration.
Those goals are pretty big, tackling things like poverty, inequality, climate change.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot to ask businesses to align their CSR efforts with something so massive.
It is ambitious, but Treitz argues that it's super important for companies to think beyond just minimizing harm. He says they need to actively look for ways to create positive change.
Okay, yeah, I can see how that would be valuable. But there are so many good causes out there.
Right.
How does a company decide where to focus their CSR efforts? You only have so many resources.
That's where those materiality assessments come in.
Okay.
It's about figuring out which social and environmental issues matter most to the company's operations and to the people who have a stake in the company. So, for example, a clothing company might prioritize ethical sourcing and making sure workers are treated fairly, while a tech company might focus on data privacy and developing AI responsibly.
Okay, that makes sense. You can't do everything, so you got to focus on the areas where you can make the biggest difference.
Exactly. And once you've figured out those key issues, you set specific goals and targets, come up with a plan to get there, and then integrate CSR into every level of the company.
So it's not just a separate CSR department. It's about weaving these ideas into the whole company.
Exactly. And that means getting everyone on board, from the CEO down to the people on the front lines. Trites talks about how important it is to have employee engagement programs, offer opportunities to volunteer, and give training on what CSR even means.
Yeah.
It's about giving employees the power to be involved in the company's CSR journey.
And it seems like collaboration is a big part of it too, right?
For sure. Companies can partner with NGOs, universities, government agencies, even other businesses to make a bigger impact and tackle complex problems that no one can solve on their own.
So it's about building a network of organizations that all want to make a positive difference.
Exactly.
Okay.
And lastly, Trites stresses the importance of transparency and accountability. It's not enough to just do good things. You have to tell people what you're doing and be willing to share both your successes and your failures.
So it's about building trust with stakeholders and showing that CSR isn't just a marketing gimmick.
Exactly. In fact, when you do CSR well, it can actually be a really strong marketing tool. It improves a company's reputation and builds trust with consumers.
And that brings us to our final article, which is a review by Linda Dean of Amanda Montell's book, The Age of Magical Overthinking, Notes on Modern Irrationality.
Interesting.
This piece really digs into how being constantly connected in this digital age is shaping how we think and behave. And it's not all good.
It's not all sunshine and roses.
No, no.
Dean highlights how the book focuses on all those anxieties, biases, and mistaken beliefs that mess with our minds, saying that our ancient survival instincts are getting hijacked by the digital world.
Okay, full disclosure, I kind of have a news addiction. Could I be falling for some of these biases without even realizing it?
It's definitely possible.
Yeah.
Montell talks about all these mental quirks that the digital world makes worse. Like, take the halo effect, for example.
Okay.
It's where we overestimate how great people we admire are, and that can make us blindly trust influencers or online personalities.
I've totally done that. It's so easy to get caught up in the hype and forget to think for yourself.
Right. And then there's the sunk cost fallacy, where we cling to things that are clearly not working.
Yes, because we've already spent so much time or money on them. It's like that saying, throwing good money after bad.
Yeah, I think we've all been there.
Yeah.
It's hard to let go, especially when you're emotionally invested.
Totally. And then there's the zero-sum bias, where we assume that if one person wins, someone else has to lose.
Oh, yeah.
This can make us think there's not enough to go around.
Yeah.
And makes us less likely to cooperate or share.
It's like that winner-take-all mentality you see everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And last but not least, there's the survivorship bias, where we only focus on the success stories and ignore all the failures we don't hear about.
Okay.
Which gives us this distorted view of reality, like thinking that success is way more common than it actually is.
It's like those social media feeds that are all about perfect lives, and then you start feeling bad about yourself.
Exactly. And that's a big takeaway from the book. What we see online is often a curated version of reality that can mess with our perceptions and make us more anxious. So what's the cure? Do we all need to chuck our smartphones and move to a cabin in the woods?
Not necessarily, but Montell does have a surprisingly low-tech solution. She suggests embracing the life-changing magic of becoming a mediocre crafter.
Mediocre. I thought we were supposed to, like, excel at things.
That's the point. Montell argues that doing hands-on creative stuff, even if you're not great at it, can help you reconnect with the real world and escape the digital overload.
It's like finding the joy in doing something, not just in being good at it.
Exactly.
And it's about putting down the screens and interacting with the world in a more mindful, hands-on way.
Yeah, and she believes that changing our focus like this can help us see things differently, worry less, and find more balance in our lives.
I like it. This has been a whirlwind tour of some really interesting topics. We've talked about the ethical dilemmas of virtual worlds, the headaches of remote auditing, the craziness of Canadian tax policy, what corporate social responsibility really means, and how the digital age is messing with our minds.
And it all ties back to that idea of figuring out how to deal with uncertainty in a world that's constantly changing.
Yeah, we've covered a lot. in this deep dive.
Yeah.
And I know our listeners have a lot to think about. So we'll be right back to continue exploring these thought-provoking articles.
Welcome back. So before the break, we were talking about that suggestion from Amanda Montell's book, you know, about dealing with all the digital overload.
Oh, yeah, that was fascinating. Becoming a mediocre crafter to reconnect with the real world, it's a good reminder that sometimes the simplest solutions are the best.
Absolutely. We get so caught up in the digital world, we forget about just making stuff with our own hands.
Okay, let's bring it back to the world of finance. We were discussing how Canadian tax policy is changing so fast and businesses are feeling the uncertainty. What does Litter actually think we can do about it? A lot of our listeners are dealing with this stuff every day.
He actually has some practical advice.
Yeah.
One big thing he recommends is for the government to actually talk to industry experts before they make new tax laws.
So it's about actually listening to the people who are affected by the changes.
Exactly. It's not just about being in the room. It's about having a voice that actually gets heard. He thinks that would lead to tax policies that actually help businesses, not hurt them.
It makes sense. You wouldn't build a house without talking to an architect, right?
Exactly. You need a plan, and everyone needs to be on the same page.
Litter also talks about how we need to understand the big picture impact of all these tax changes.
Right. He means understanding that tax policies don't exist in a vacuum. Every change has consequences that can affect other parts of the economy.
So it's not enough to look at one policy on its own.
No.
You have to see how it fits in with everything else.
Exactly. And that requires a much bigger picture approach to how we develop tax policy, one that considers how everything's connected and the potential for things to go wrong, even with good intentions.
It sounds complicated.
It is.
Is there even a way to simplify things and make taxes more predictable for businesses?
That's the big question. Litter thinks we should stop constantly changing the tax code and instead create a system that's stable and predictable.
Yeah.
So businesses can plan for the future.
I think we can all agree on that. Uncertainty makes it hard to invest and innovate.
Absolutely. And it creates an environment where businesses are more worried about following the rules than about growing.
Okay, let's go back to Kim Moody's article about those journalism tax credits.
Oh, yeah.
We talked about it a bit earlier, but I think it's worth another look because it really raises some fundamental questions about the role of government in the media.
It's a complicated issue, for sure.
On one hand, you have the argument that a truly free press shouldn't be influenced by the government, even if it just looks that way.
Right.
But then on the other hand, the journalism industry is struggling. A lot of news organizations are going out of business. So is it the government's job to step in and help?
That's the debate, isn't it? Moody thinks these tax credits, while well-intentioned, set a dangerous precedent because they give the government a say in which news organizations succeed and which ones fail.
He's really worried about that expert panel that decides who qualifies for the credits.
Yeah, and with good reason. Anytime you have a group chosen by the government deciding who gets money, there's a chance for bias and political influence.
It's like that saying, he who pays the piper calls the tune. If news organizations rely on the government for money, it could affect what they choose to report on.
Exactly. And that could make people lose trust in the media.
So what's the alternative? If we all agree that the journalism industry is in trouble, how can we help without messing with its independence?
That's the million-dollar question. Moody suggests trying different approaches, like getting funding from philanthropists or having communities support their local journalism.
Okay.
Things that let news organizations stay independent from the government.
So it sounds like we need a much bigger discussion about the role of journalism in a democracy and how we can make sure it survives without losing its integrity.
Exactly. A free and independent press is essential for a healthy democracy. So we need to find ways to support it without messing with those core principles.
Let's move on to Gerald Treitz's article on corporate social responsibility. He lays out a really thorough plan for companies that want to make CSR a central part of their business strategies.
It's a really helpful guide for those who want to go beyond the surface and truly integrate social and environmental considerations into how they operate.
We talked about those materiality assessments earlier, but can you explain how companies can actually put CSR initiatives into action? I know our listeners want to know what steps they can take.
Of course. Once a company figures out its key material issues, the next step is to set specific goals and targets. These need to be measurable and align with the overall goals of the business.
So it's not just about having good intentions. It's about having specific objectives that you can track and measure.
Exactly. And then you create action plans to achieve those goals. This might mean changing things like how you buy supplies, manage your supply chain, design your products, or even how you train your employees.
It sounds like a lot of work. How do you make sure CSR isn't just happening in one department, but that the whole company is involved?
Great question. Trite says it's all about making CSR everyone's responsibility. You need to create a culture where social and environmental factors are part of every decision at every level of the company.
So it's about making CSR part of the company's DNA.
Precisely. And that requires strong leadership from the top. The CEO has to be a true believer in CSR and make it clear that it's a core value of the company.
But it's not just about orders from the top. It's about giving employees the power to be part of the company's CSR journey, right?
Absolutely. Trites talks about the importance of things like employee engagement programs, giving people opportunities to volunteer, and providing training on what CSR actually means.
It's about making CSR part of the employee experience and giving everyone a sense of ownership.
Exactly. And it can even help you attract and keep good employees. More and more, especially younger people, want to work for companies that share their values.
So it's not just about doing good, it's about doing well as a business.
Exactly. It's about recognizing that a company's success is tied to the well-being of its stakeholders and the health of the planet.
Okay, last question on CSR. How do you measure whether these initiatives are actually making a difference?
That's a really important part. Trites emphasizes the need for continuous monitoring and evaluation.
Okay.
Companies have to track their progress towards their goals, measure the actual impact of their actions, and be willing to adjust their approach based on what they learn.
So it's a process of constantly improving.
Absolutely. And it's about being open with stakeholders, sharing both your successes and your failures.
It seems like CSR is becoming less about charity and more about making social and environmental considerations a core part of how a company does business.
You're right. It's no longer just a nice to have. It's becoming essential for companies that want to succeed in today's world.
This has been a really interesting discussion about how business and finance are changing. We've talked about the ethics of the metaverse, the challenges of remote auditing, the complexities of Canadian tax policy, and the evolving role of CSR.
And it's all connected by this idea of navigating uncertainty and adapting to a world that's in constant flux.
We've covered a lot today.
We have.
I'm sure our listeners have a lot to think about.
They do.
We'll be back in a moment to wrap up our deep dive into the fall 2024 issue of Think 2020 magazine.
Welcome back. It's amazing how these articles from Think 2020 can connect things like virtual reality, remote auditing, and Canadian tax policy, all through this idea of dealing with uncertainty.
I know. It's like they were handpicked for this deep dive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, speaking of uncertainty, that last article, Linda Dean's review of The Age of Magical Overthinking, really got to me. It made me think about how easily we can fall into these mental traps, especially in the digital age.
Yeah, that book really resonated with me, too. Montel's argument that our ancient survival instincts are basically being hijacked by this modern digital world we live in is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
We are just constantly bombarded with information, and a lot of it is designed to trigger our emotions, not make us think critically.
It's like we're just scrolling and scrolling through social media and news, reacting to everything without really stopping to ask if it's even true.
Exactly. And that's where those biases come in. We tend to look for information that supports what we already believe, even if it's wrong. And we overestimate the importance of information that's easy to find while ignoring stuff that's harder to dig up.
It's like that saying, what you see is all there is. We build these echo chambers around ourselves online and offline, and it becomes really hard to see the bigger picture.
Absolutely. And that can have big consequences, not just for us personally, but for the decisions we make in our professional lives. If we're not aware of our biases, we can make bad investments, misjudge risks, even damage our reputations.
So how do we escape these mental traps?
Montel suggests a few things. One is to be skeptical of information, especially if it comes from sources that already agree with you.
So like double check things, get different perspectives, and be open to being wrong.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's also important to be aware of how you're feeling when you're taking in information. If you're stressed, anxious, or angry, you're more likely to let bias take over.
That makes sense. It's like when you're starving, everything looks good to eat. You need to take a step back and think clearly before making a decision.
Right. And lastly, Montel talks about developing a growth mindset. It's about being open to learning new things, even if it means admitting you were wrong, and being willing to change your mind when there's good evidence.
So it's about realizing that learning never ends, and there's always something new to discover.
Exactly.
I think that's a perfect way to wrap things up. This deep dive into the fall 2024 issue of Think 2020 has been incredible. We've explored the ethics of virtual reality, the challenges of remote auditing, the uncertainties of Canadian tax policy, the evolving role of CSR, and how the digital age affects our thinking.
And it's all connected by this idea of navigating a world that's constantly changing and figuring out how to handle uncertainty.
So what's the main takeaway for our listeners?
Stay curious, be a little skeptical, be aware of your biases, and never stop learning. The world is changing fast, and the best way to keep up is to stay informed, stay engaged, and stay curious.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We'll be back next time with more thought-provoking articles to explore. Until then, keep learning, keep thinking, and stay curious.